Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Chris Cipollone never set out to be that guy who wrote a book about depression and Christianity. It kind of just happened. The beginnings of his book were a few thoughts scribbled down to himself during a particularly bad episode, in fact, while in hospital, trying to work out what the Bible said that would make any sense of what he was going through. It was a serious episode of depression. Those thoughts have grown into a book called Down, Not Out, Depression, Anxiety, and the Difference Jesus Makes. Chris's book sits in that space between what we know and what we feel. That space is sometimes called cognitive dissonance, but for believers it can challenge the core of our faith. We're supposed to rejoice in the Lord, but how can we when we feel so wretched ourselves? How can the light of life break into the darkness that we feel right now? Well, Chris is a son of God. He's a follower of Jesus. He's a husband and father. For a job, he's a minister. He ministers to a church in northern Sydney. He describes himself as a person who lives with depression. That's a description that I like. Now, I'm going to be frank with you. I approached this conversation with great caution. I'm a person who lives with depression. That's been a companion for me for a long, long time. And as anyone with this condition knows, it comes and goes. So I approached this conversation with caution because, as a Christian, I've sat in church where the minister has used the prevalence of antidepressant medications in the community as an illustration of society's ills or something or other. I'm not entirely sure what point was being made. It just made me feel like it was my fault for not having enough faith. It's not an uncommon experience, I think, for Christians who live with depression. We have come a long way as a society, but just as depression is not understood outside of the community of believers, so it is within the community of believers. You'll still hear people saying, can't you just cheer up? Well, Chris's book and this conversation endeavour to take a more thoughtful look at depression from a biblical perspective.
Obviously, I've had years to reflect on this now. Having written a book helps clarify your own thinking on this a lot. And it shouldn't surprise us. I mean, we have a worldview where we live in a broken creation.
Yeah.
We follow a Christ who, yes, has a victorious resurrection, but has to go through a painful crucifixion to get there. Following Jesus is not just following him into his glory. It's also following him into his suffering too. And, you know, Garden of Gethsemane, he endured enormous mental and emotional anguish there. And the gospel, I think, at its core is recognize need. Those who come to faith in Christ and those who don't, the separation ultimately is recognizing that you need one greater than yourself, that you're weak and vulnerable within yourself, that there are imperfections. And so to recognize our own weakness, I don't think should be an affront to our worldview. In fact, it should be confirmed by our worldview.
Well, Chris, tell us your story. What happened at Disney World?
Disney World, of all places in the world, was the first place I had my first suicidal thought.
Happiest place on earth.
Happiest place on earth, and I wasn't happy. And that was more than irony. That was actually very linked because, you know, what I like to tell people, and I think one of the potential misconceptions about those of us who live with depression is that we're always sad, we're always down. But for me, it was actually, I think, an overly inflated optimism that led to my depression ultimately.
What do you mean by that?
When I finished school and entered my adult life, I had hopes and dreams for what my life was going to look like. And in hindsight, they were always unrealistic. I just didn't know it at the time. And so, you know, we talk about the you can do anything generation, and I was a product of that. I'd mistaken that for you can do everything. And when I couldn't do everything that I wanted to do with my life, and I realized there were going to be some things that I had in my hopes and dreams that I wasn't actually going to be able to achieve, that left me deeply disillusioned. And so Disney World represented, if you like, one of the last frontiers of happiness. I'd already gotten married. My marriage was great. I love my wife. But, you know, like all of us who are married, we realize it's not the answer to all of life's problems. I'd gotten a degree. That wasn't a given in my family background. I'd gotten a good job. And so I'd kicked these life goals. But one thing I hadn't done was travel. And so, when we ultimately went traveling at age 25, Disney World, again, marketed the happiest place on earth, was exactly what I was looking for. But when I got there, it was hot. The food was expensive. Kids were crying. The lines for rides were long. You know, and I just thought, this is not the happiest place on earth. And if this isn't, where on earth can I find happiness? And it was actually that separation between my expectation and reality was so large that I didn't know what to do with that disappointment. And actually, it drove me to have a suicidal thought when I just wasn't expecting it. It blindsided me completely.
Cognitive dissonance, they call it, don't they, between the expectation of something and it not meeting the expectation. So you get a profound disappointment, even maybe an anger and a bitterness. But that's very different from moving from there to a suicidal thought. Was there biological condition as well that this had exacerbated? I mean, why did it go to that level?
Yeah, the suicidal thought was, I guess, the confirmation of what was going on for a number of years that I didn't have an understanding of myself. It first sparked as social relationships started to change at about the age 21, feeling the grief of the former life of being, I guess, a student, these relationships that you've got, and then seeing life change into the career years, the marriage years, and just coming to terms with all of that. but certainly the biological disposition, you know, in pastoral ministry now, very rarely do I see it being purely biological or purely behavioural. There is this complex landscape at play where you've got these predisposed susceptibilities to this. But when you're not aware of that and you start to go through life and you start to make decisions and you start to respond to them in certain ways, it's challenging to know where is one coming from and where is another starting to come in.
Yeah, which is why a lot of the treatment involves cognitive therapy as well as sometimes medication and other forms of therapy as well. Your second serious bout of depression, Chris, was just after you were, when you were about to finish Bible college, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you ended up in hospital. But
yeah.
What was going on there?
That was about 5 years after the Disney World experience, and I'd gone back to teaching. That's what I was doing at the time. Had a real crisis with that, thinking, I don't know if I can do that the rest of my life. People talk about having a calling to go to Bible college. For me, it was almost a process of deduction. what do I want to do the most? What do I enjoy doing the most? And it came down to ministry. And so I'd entered Bible college thinking actually school chaplaincy was the likely option, given that it made sense combining that with my education experience. At the start of my final year of college, I'd been doing student ministry at a church, and the minister at the time said that he thought there'd be a position for me. I didn't have to make a decision about it right then and there. I actually had until about September, which sounds like a mercy to have 9 months to make that decision.
Oh, no, it sounds to me like an agony.
Well, for someone who's prone to anxiety and depression, that's absolutely what it became. And especially given that the plan, if you like, had been chaplaincy, and yet the opportunity seemed to be something else, dealing with, I guess, the question, God, what do you want me to do? Was the question that came up that whole year.
Now, okay, let me investigate that. You undeniably, this is something that you're asking God and you're earnestly seeking his will and you're waiting upon him. But isn't there a big element of psychology in there as well? Because it's not just, God, what do you want me to do? But it's, what do I want to be when I grow up?
Yes.
How do I imagine myself to be if I was to be a happy, successful person?
Yes.
What would that look like?
The value was coming from what I did. Who I was what I did.
Yeah.
Now, they're not the same thing, but in my mind, that's what I'd built up.
Oh, and so it is for so many people.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And again, where a Christian worldview, I think, has to play into this is the gospel message is, who are you, not what do you do? And who are you as a beloved child of God? And that has to have implications for how we look at ourselves, how we look at what the purpose of life is, and how we navigate challenges. So coming back to how did I end up in hospital, again, January was when that conversation happened. I was literally on seek.com, you know, an hour a day, just looking for future possibilities. The desktop of my computer, I still remember, was filled with spreadsheets about the financial implications of every single decision path that I could make at that point.
Oh, Chris, you had it bad.
And I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I'd known that I'd wrestled with depression, but it just got worse and worse. And the thing that was described to me afterwards, actually, when I was in hospital, was the concept of rumination. And I'd never heard the word before, but it was described to me as when you think you're strategizing your way out of a problem, but you're only sinking deeper and deeper.
Yes.
And that's exactly what that year was for me.
It goes along with catastrophic thinking.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, fast forward these 9 months and, you know, it took a huge toll on my wife, Lara, because she was essentially my daily counselor.
Yes, yes.
And I remember September 19th was the day I had to make the decision about the job. On September the 17th, I walked the streets of my neighborhood and for the first time ever in my life, asked God for the lightning bolt. You know, God, this is the time you need to come through for me. You know, make it start raining or make it stop raining. You know, that really, I need you to tell me what to do because I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't give it to me. And I got home at 3 a.m. after walking these streets and said to Lara, I need more help. And I'd been seeing a psychologist. I'd started medication. I didn't know what I was asking for by more help. I just knew that the level of help I was getting wasn't quite hitting the spot.
Mm.
Lara had known somebody who'd been in a private psychiatric hospital earlier that year. She made some calls and got a doctor's referral. And so that Friday, the September 19th, the day that I was meant to make a decision about the job, I actually walked into the doors of the psychiatric hospital.
Our guest on Open House is Chris Cipollone. He's the author of Down, Not Out, just recently released, and it's a book about one Christian's journey through depression and anxiety. Chris, the moment you came to that point where you said, I need more help, that's the turning point, isn't it? And I've spoken to so many people for whom there's a turning point, and it's always an acceptance that what's happening at the moment can't go on. And that's for you, was that a process of like giving up or giving over or realizing your own vulnerability?
Absolutely. All of those words, Stephen. I tell people my breaking point was my turning point. And again, filtering that through what I call a gospel identity in the book, asking the question, who am I? Ultimately, I'm loved by God and dependent on his grace. I think of it like the foundations with which we build our life. And I'd been building a foundation through my 20s of happiness and comfort. That was always going to come shattering down at one point or another. And when I wasn't happy and I wasn't comfortable, it inevitably forces you to ask the question as a depressive, well, what's the point of living? You know, if these things are not coming through for me, is there any point? And either you give up hope or you conclude that there's another paradigm with which you can live life through.
And which did you choose, he said, anticipating the answer.
Yes.
Another paradigm.
Absolutely another paradigm. It was, a psychologist had described it to me as maturity.
Maturity as opposed to happiness.
Absolutely. Which I say in the book, I hated him for saying that at the time because I didn't want to accept that that was the alternative.
Well, they're harsh words. No one wants to be told they're not mature.
Absolutely. So not only was it happiness isn't going to get it done, but it was also, do I even want to be mature? Is that really? Yeah. It's like when, you know, in scripture talks about us being slaves to righteousness and how good that is. It's like, do I really want to be a slave to righteousness? And, you know, there's these competing desires in our life that we wrestle with.
All right, well, let's unpack what that all meant, because I don't think we can understand this story any further without peeling back the layers of your relationship with God and, in fact, God, the way God has set us up as human beings. So let's go first to the question of maturity. What this psychologist said to you was, as I understand it, Chris, you've been pursuing happiness. Happiness is not an end in itself. What the Bible talks to us about the journey being one towards maturity. Okay, so when we say maturity in that context, what's meant by that?
Yeah. The briefest, I guess, summary I could give is from the book of Colossians, when Paul says that all things are from God and for God. That changes the paradigm of why we're here. If all things are from him, which I believe they are, and all things are given for his glory, then even my days of darkness and suffering actually, I think, often give me more of an opportunity to recognize that life is from him and for him, because suffering refines you like comfort never does. And the beauty of filtering life through maturity is that no day is wasted, because you have a choice every day, whether you're depressed or not, to worship God or not. Do you want to bring honor to him with your life or not? And that process is very refining. It leads to maturity, but we can choose to live our own way if we want.
So would you include in your definition of biblical maturity realistic self-awareness?
Certainly. And I think that realistic self-awareness for all of us, whether we're depressed or not, is a recognition that we are not God.
Mm.
Now, that's a very humbling thing to come to terms with. Are we content to be one of his creation, beloved, dearly beloved, absolutely, but still not the creator of our own lives? Are we happy to let God be God? You know, it strikes me so much that in the garden, Adam and Eve wanted the knowledge of good and evil.
Hmm.
There's always been something about us in our humanity that has craved a higher level of understanding about why things happen.
Hmm.
And God is telling us, I don't promise that answer. You know, in Philippians 4, Paul talks about having the peace that transcends understanding.
Yes, he does.
So he doesn't actually promise us understanding, but he does promise us peace. And so to use the maturity paradigm and in intersecting that with the happiness paradigm, if you like, another option there, the more mature option, is looking at life with joy. And joy is not happiness. Kay Warren says in her book, Choose Joy, that it's the settled assurance that everything is going to be okay. The only way you can say that genuinely without it just being cold comfort, hopeful optimism, is the cross of Jesus Christ.
Okay, so the settled assurance that everything is going to be okay. Now, at this point, people with depression will say, well, this is words. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I feel terrible. Nothing gives me happiness. Nothing gives me joy. What does that even mean? Don't even know what it looks like. Everything is dark. Are you offering, is the gospel offering, is your book offering, Chris Cipollone, that in fact, yeah, that's a real experience and you can't wave a magic wand and make it better? Is that what you're offering?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, joy is actually the recognition that life is hard, because joy is not happiness. It's fighting for it.
Okay, so where is the hope for a depressed person in that?
There are two kinds of hope, I think. Again, to quote Paul, I think the book of Philippians is incredibly helpful for those of us who are navigating mental illness. It says, to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I'm going living with the Father, I'd prefer that. But for as long as he has me here, I'm going to keep on serving. I'm going to keep on loving you. That's to paraphrase, obviously. I think that idea gives us two forms of hope. Number one, yes, we do have the hope of a new creation. We also have the hope of the dignity of the here and now, to live is Christ. Even if my life on the outside looks hopeless, even if I'm functioning on a level that is just breaking my heart. You know, I was once asked, what's the hardest thing about depression? I think it's, for me at the time, I answered, not living up to my potential. But to live is Christ is possible at every single day. One of the stories I tell in the book is about the widow and the two coins at the temple offertory. Now, there's a financial parable there, if you like, of relative versus absolute generosity.
Hmm.
But if you think about that widow, and at times I thought about my own depression forcing me into the widow's status. You know, my life looked pretty dysfunctional. You know, I wasn't doing the things I wanted to do. I was once, you know, the one giving abundantly into the temple collection. And here I am now with just two coins, emotional coins, if you like, that all I could spend it on is getting out of bed that day and that's it. I'm done. Has that day been wasted? No, because I've used what I've got to honour Christ.
Chris, that's the answer to one of the paradoxes of depression, perhaps, that on the outside things look fine. To the outside world, you can be a functioning, whatever, in your case, a teacher or a Bible teacher or a pastor of a church, you can be fine. You can get up and speak in front of hundreds of people without problems on the outside. But on the inside, there's this massive mismatch. Is that where you think the parable of the woman at the...
Yeah, I think it's also, it's a reminder for those of us who don't understand depression personally,
mm.
to just show a bit of kindness to people, to ask the question, hey, what's going on?
Mm.
You know, I don't think she'll mind me sharing. The editor of my book was leading music ministry. She was leading kids ministry, and she got hit with this, and she had to start pulling out of things. She just couldn't do it. And instead of asking, are you okay? The expression was one of disappointment that, you know, are you slack?
Hmm.
You know, so she'd gone from having riches to give to two coins to give. And those in her church, first of all, didn't ask why. but also pretty much made her feel even worse for only being able to give that much.
Mm.
And so Jesus looks at that for what it actually is. Everyone else is looking at the temple leaders going, aren't they great?
Mm.
Jesus looks at the widow and says, isn't that beautiful? And actually, in terms of how we see ourselves and the hope that we have for our life, if all we have on any given day is two coins, my message is, that's okay. Jesus says, that's okay. Other people might not understand. You might judge yourself by your own standard and say, that's not okay.
Mm.
But over and above, Jesus is saying, give me what you've got. And that's what I think it is to live as Christ. You know, Paul's in prison when he writes that. Yeah, his ministry influence, if you like, is limited by where he is. He's in chains. And yet, he can still say every day to live is Christ.
Yes.
And that's where I think that's actually the counter for losing hope for those of us with faith. Yes, the new creation will be better. And at the same time, each and every day of your life now has purpose, if the purpose is maturity and joy. If it's happiness and comfort, we have every reason to give up because we're not happy and we're not comfortable. But if it's joy in our salvation, joy in God's love, joy in the dignity that we have, that we were made by Him and for Him, we can do that whether we're depressed or not. You know, if anything, I want to share my story to show that there is hope. When I went into hospital, I didn't actually think I was going to get better. I did it for my family, that maybe one day it might be different. But deep down, I didn't really believe it. Now, everyone's journey is going to be different. And the last thing I want to do is prescribe my journey looking like your journey. But what I do know is that God is with you in all seasons of life. And I do believe, even if you live with depression for the rest of your life, I've not met anybody who didn't waver in the severity from time to time.
Yeah.
And you have to recognize that there are seasons. And the difficulty with mental illness is that when you're in a dark season, your brain is not functioning as it ought, and you don't actually believe that that season will ever end.
Mm.
And I think the hardest season of living with depression is the first, because you don't have the reference point to be able to look back and go, look how God delivered me out of that season.
Mm.
You know, if I relapse again, which statistics say I probably will, because I've relapsed twice. Now, I'm not going to hope for that. But if it does happen, I've got past experience to draw on to see that God can sustain me. But when it's your first time going through it, it's very, very hard.
Our guest is Chris Cipollone, the author of Down, Not Out. He's a minister in a local church in Sydney and a sufferer of depression. I once spoke at an event for 1,000-plus teachers. And it was a very down day for me, a down period. But the message that I felt was appropriate for them was that, and these were teachers in Christian schools, I said, you know, you'll give the kids in your classes lots of great equipment to face life with, things that they know, things that they can do. But if there's one thing that you leave them with, that God loves them and that they're valued and precious, you know, to take through life, then that'll be what a contribution you will have made as a teacher in a Christian school. Well, at morning tea time, this guy comes up to me, a teacher, and he said, are you okay? Wow. Because I wasn't okay.
Mm.
And he went on to reveal that he'd not been okay and been through similar experiences to you. And he said, there was a day when he couldn't see in front of him, you know, just in that darkest pit.
Yeah.
He said, the only thing that made any sense to me, and I couldn't feel it, I just knew it as a cognitive fact, was that Jesus had been there before me in that dark pit.
Yeah. I think that's spot on. There's so much to unpack with that story. First of all, that's a mercy for those of us who go through this, is we can recognize and care for others. We see things because we've been through it. The second thing you mentioned was about feelings, and this is one of the things I talk about in the book. I find it fascinating in pastoral ministry to different generations. Often what you'll hear older generations start a sentence with is, I think that, ...
Yes.
Younger generations say, I feel like.
Yes.
You know, feelings have this currency, particularly with younger generations, I think higher than ever. And feelings are a gift of God to help us indicate what's going on, but they can't be the be-all and end-all.
Mm.
You know, especially for those of us whose brain function is not as it ought, our feelings at times will betray reality. And if we just finish with our feelings, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. We need to be willing to challenge our feelings.
Yeah.
You can feel hopeless. That doesn't mean you are hopeless. You can feel unlovable. That doesn't mean you are unlovable. And this is where, you know, your message, leave these kids with knowing that God loves them.
Mm.
That is the single most beautiful gift you can give to somebody who is living with depression. Because if you walk long enough with somebody who's suffering, you'll begin to find them pretty difficult to love.
Mm.
It's not always easy to be around someone with depression.
Mm.
But you also need to remember that whatever you're observing about them, they are living within on the inside. They can't remove themselves from themselves. And so, at least for me, you know, when I'm in the pit of depression, I'm not feeling worthy of anybody's love. I know how unattractive I am in that moment. You know, I'm not loving myself at that moment.
Yeah.
And so, this alternative love needs to be the antidote. And what is it? It's the love of God. It's the cross of Christ confirming what God says, that he would not even spare his own son for me. I am worthy of his love. I have enough dignity for him to have done that. And even when I'm at my worst, I'm still worthy of it.
You're on Open House and listening to my conversation with Chris Cipollone. He's the author of Down Not Out, Depression, Anxiety and the Difference Jesus Makes. You'll hear more of this conversation in a moment or two. I do pray that whether you're a person who lives with depression or a person who helps a person who lives with depression, I do pray that this may be speaking to you tonight. Well, here's a question. When Jesus cried out on the cross, "Why have you forsaken me?" when he prayed alone in the Garden of Gethsemane, what was happening for him in those moments? That's what we'll discuss with Chris next. But before we do, let's take a moment to draw breath with a song that, as you'll hear shortly, was hugely significant for Chris Cipollone in his own journey. Featuring Brooke Fraser, this is Hillsong and the Desert Song.
This is my prayer in the desert, when all that's within me feels dry. This is my prayer in the hunger and need. My God is the God who provides. And this is my prayer in the fire, in weakness or triangle or pain. There is a faith proved of more worth than gold. So refine
Yeah, featuring Brooke Fraser. That's Hillsong Australia and Desert Song. And you're on Open House right around Australia, where our guest is Chris Cipollone, the author of Down Not Out, a book about being a Christian and living with depression. Well, Chris, what was happening for Jesus in that moment on the cross when he called out those chilling words, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" What was happening?
Separation, heartache, you know, that journey of the passion, if you like, you know, we see beginning in earnest in Gethsemane.
Hmm.
And yet he concludes, "Not my will, but yours."
Hmm.
You know, that is a son who trusts his father. That's a son who is, if you like, willing to challenge his own conclusions and see that there is a God who is doing everything. It's absolute anguish, but at the end of the day, he knows he's got to do it, and he wants to do it for us.
Are we seeing feelings overcome by reason? I mean, it's rather impertinent of us to speculate at that moment, is it? Yeah. I'm not sure.
I've thought about the Gethsemane moment a lot.
Yeah.
The moment of when he cries that out on the cross, I don't know. Hebrews 4, I think, is an interesting passage where the author tells us that Jesus Christ was tempted in every way as we are, yet he did not sin.
Hmm.
And so, let us approach the throne with confidence, and that Jesus is able to sympathize with our weakness because he has been tempted.
Hmm.
What Jesus provides is not just intellectual love, but he can genuinely say, "You know what you're feeling today? I was there. You know, I know what that's like. Come to me."
Mm.
You know, I talk about prayer in the book, and I think we have to break some of our cultural assumptions about prayer. Prayers don't have to be nice. You know, you look in Lamentations, you look in Jeremiah, you look in the Psalms.
Mm.
These are unpleasant prayers. You know, Job, does he cross the line? Jeremiah, does he cross the line? I don't know. But what I do know is that they are heartfelt. There is no layer of niceness to those prayers. And I don't think we need to be. Like, honouring to God and respectful, yes, but he already knows what's in our heart. And if Hebrews is right, which I think it is, he's been there himself, we can run to him as one who knows what that's like. We don't have to protect him from our own feelings.
Yes, I sometimes think back to what my friend told me, and I imagine him there. And at that moment, I don't think he ran to Christ, but I imagine Christ being there, like perhaps you turn around and Jesus is sitting with you.
Mm.
And maybe he's got his arm around your shoulder.
Mm.
And maybe he's just saying, "It's okay. I'm just here, and I'll be here as long as you need me to be here,
yeah.
And it's okay, let's just wait."
If I can share a story, you know, I talked about when I walked the streets waiting for the lightning bolt moment, and it was actually the next week in hospital. The Friday I was admitted, the Monday I was doing physical therapy, basically a gym session in order to improve mental health, and I passed out. and that's where the book begins. It's me on the floor, passed out in the floor of a psychiatric hospital, asking, "What am I at this point in my life?"
Yes.
But I say in the book, you know, God, I do believe God spoke to me. And again, I'm not saying the same will happen for you. I'm not prescribing. But his mercy in that moment was actually the words of a song, Desert Song. And it has a refrain, "All of my life, in every season, you are still God. And I have a reason to sing. I have a reason to worship."
Mm.
And that was Christ's way of being with me in my darkest moment.
Mm. And so often the stories that we hear at this radio station are that songs that we play here are that moment for people. I think God does amazing things through ministries like this.
I actually told the musicians at our church that to say, "Isn't it interesting that it was the words of a song that came to me?" And I look at my kids, you know, they're young, but they're already singing the songs we sing at church.
Mm.
There's something beautiful about the power of song that we remember. And I just love that song is God's design. You know, song is not a culturally constructed thing that we've invented. Song is a gift of God.
Chris Cipollone is with us. He's the author of Down Not Out. How did your story kind of, well, we don't know how it ends yet, because here you are sitting here and you're in your 30s or something.
Yep.
So we don't know how it ends, but how did it turn out after these depressive incidents?
Yeah, I mean, the staff team at my church were amazing. I ended up taking the job actually after coming out of hospital. So it was a 3-week program. I did 2 of them. I was discharged at the psychiatrist's advice, but undertook a 12-week outpatient program after that. It's looked like remaining on medication since then, which I'm deeply thankful for. It's been the 5th, I think, medication I've been on,
Oh, yes. And
the first one I feel like has really hit the spot.
Mm.
It's looked like providing hope to others. I mean, this book began actually in hospital, writing my own thoughts, and the question became, okay, I've just done 3 years of theology. What would I say to somebody in this situation theologically? And I started preaching to myself, if you like, and that's how the book came to be. It's looked like, you know, in many ways, going from strength to strength. God's challenged me in different ways. I've had twins since then, and that was a challenge in itself to think about, how's this going to impact my mental health? 4 kids in 4.5 years and sleep deprivation and all that goes with that. But God has sustained me, and it doesn't mean that every day has been easy. I tell people that I live with depression, and that's a very intentional phrase that I use, that I'm not cured, but I am better. And it is possible to live with this. You know, it doesn't have to debilitate you to the point where life becomes untenable.
No, certainly not.
It's about management. And so I live with it, and I'm functioning, and hopefully I'm blessing other people through the book and at church. And again, God's power is made perfect in our weakness. I really believe that. And if anything, this has just taught me more and more to rely on God's strength on a personal level, and to be able to communicate that on a public level now. It's a delight to be able to do that.
All right. So just to close up, a couple of maybe pieces of advice for the person with depression and for the person caring for the person with depression. The one who says, well, I'm depressed. I'm a Christian. I know I shouldn't be. I should be rejoicing in the Lord. And I'm just, there it is, another failure in my life because I can't even get being a Christian right. That person, what do you say to them?
Show grace to yourself, like the grace that God shows you.
Nice.
You know, I think there are 2 seasons with this. There is, I call it the survival season and the reflection season.
Mm.
Depending on where you are, if it's a survival season and you're just coping with life, only just, it's not the time to be asking those kinds of questions. That's the time to, I guess, do what I did and recognize that you need more help. It's not the time to philosophically reflect on, why did this happen? Is there something wrong with me? You know, it's the time to get that medication or get that treatment or whatever it is at the hands of the experts that are recommending you do it. You know, maybe in time you'll begin to think, as I did, okay, what were the things that I was thinking that I need to challenge myself on?
Mm.
Why was career the thing that I had put all my eggs into that basket?
Mm.
But when I was in hospital, it was not the time to ask that question.
Mm.
And so I just say, show yourself a bit of kindness. And also, I think if I can say anything in terms of general mental health awareness that I think we need to go, we've got the statistics. I think we've dropped the stigma, if you like. We know that it's out there. We know how prevalent it is. People are willing to accept that. What we need to now reflect on is, okay, what do we do about that? How do we respond to that? And the first thing I think we need to break down again is that this is a 6 to 8 week recovery kind of situation. Just get on the right medication. Just see a doctor. And in 8 weeks, you'll be back on your feet. Actually, that's not how this works for the most part. You know, God is capable of anything. He can heal on the spot if he wants to. But you also see in experience from others that this is a long-term thing. And so the person who's saying, oh, I'm a bad Christian or I don't have enough faith, ask those questions later down the track.
Yes, your thinking isn't entirely clear right now. You know that because of the way you're feeling.
Yep.
Put that question on the shelf for a little bit.
And patience is not a virtue that we find easy.
And to the person around the one with depression?
I think similar. Show them kindness.
Mm.
Whatever way that you can to show them that they are loved is profound, because they are not feeling loved.
Yes. Demonstrations are good.
Yep.
And don't preach.
No, don't preach. I once had a really good piece of advice from someone that said, whatever you were doing with them before they were depressed, keep doing with them. Mm. You know, they might not take you up on the offer, but if your way of relating was a cup of tea and some chocolates, do the cup of tea and some chocolates with them. Show them that you're still there for them. If it's, you know, getting out and going for a walk, offer to go for the walk. Again, whether they take you up on it is one thing, but just being that stable presence in their life and where your love is not contingent on their lovability, if you like, but that you show them you love them because you love them and they have dignity and worth because of who they are,
yes,
not because of what they're capable of doing.
Yes,
that's the best thing you can give them. You know, that will take its toll on you. And one of the things I say in the book is you may need to, as you walk with someone, get some sort of debrief counseling yourself.
Hmm.
But the person that you're caring for is not the person to give that. Showing them sacrificial love, showing them that they are worthy of your time, because ultimately that's what God says to us in the gospel. You are worthy of my love, and I will stick with you through thick and thin.
Chris Cipollone, you've been very generous with your time and your insights. Thank you for telling us your story.
Thanks, Stephen.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.